Welcome to Lawyering Up. This is a very special episode. We are coming to you live via satellite from our homes. I am Jarrett Barantino. With me is attorney Edward Saramboli. And one of my dearest friends in the world is our guest today, attorney Michael Lombardo. Michael is a partner at Horgan, Kluger & Quinn, a well-respected member of the bar. But Michael, as much as we'd love to have you, due to your legal acumen, you're here today to talk about another one of your passions, and that's emergency services. Michael, in addition to his demanding schedule as an attorney, serves in the greater Pittston community as the chairman of the city council in the city of Pittston, where he's on his third term in city council. Right, Michael? Is it three?
That's right. Yep.
Third term. You had a good campaign manager that first time.
Absolutely.
And I could tell you, Michael has been one of my best friends in the world, but his passion for emergency services is really something very special. He's been a part of saving a lot of lives and contributing back to our community as a member of our Pittston Fire Department. And no one can doubt the Lombardo legacy at the Greater Pittston Department from the late John Lombardo, which inspired Michael to get into that department. But Michael's real passion, we're finally getting to the real passion of Michael, is the Ambulance Association. And Michael has been the president of that association, remains an administrator, and has been recently named as the chairman of the Emergency Services Committee of the Crisis Management Team. Eddie and I are part of that team. We're part of the legal team. I'm the chairman of that team. Eddie and Greg have been integral in moving forward as we help Dave Pedry and our county as a whole deal with this crisis. With that, Michael, we're proud and honored to have you here and look forward to speaking with you today.
Thanks for having me on. Know you guys a long time, as we chatted about before we got on the podcast. I have a lot of respect for both of you and your passion for the legal profession and for our community as a whole.
You know, one of the things that Jared and I want to talk to you about, Mike, is what are you seeing from, I mean, you're you know, we're in our houses doing right. What the governor's asked us to do, and you know, not really going anywhere other than to, you know, get groceries or you got to get medicine. But I mean, you're still out there on the front lines with the first responders and the EMS crews and the paramedics. Tell us what you're seeing there and give us some perspective on what's going on.
One thing I'll say, and a lot of people have asked me, is how are our personnel doing? How are our crews doing? And by and large, everyone is doing well and handling it, kind of taking it in stride. You know, obviously emergency work is different in the sense that you never know what you're going to face. So this is just kind of another challenge that gets thrown in your path. And the mission is to adapt and overcome. So I would say that by and large, our crew members are in very good spirits, kind of taking it in stride. I mean, there's a certain level of anxiety, and it's not really so much about yourself getting the disease, but we're worried, you know, when we go home and we have to be around we're around our loved ones and our families, you know, you worry about what you're bringing home. I mean, that's always a concern, not just with coronavirus the last couple of weeks, but there's a lot of things that we need to do as responders to make sure that we're not bringing anything home with us. It's something simple as, you know, things that you wouldn't think about, but the footwear that people wear when they're going to work, your work boots, you don't want to come back into your house wearing your work boots. So you have to think about little things like that and keeping yourself clean so you're not bringing home the virus to your loved ones. So we're just thinking about things that a month ago really weren't on the forefront of our mind, but now have to be. So that's one thing that, you know, I kind of want to put out there, that our responders are really taking it in stride and really doing well and have a good attitude, sort of a can-do spirit, and we'll get through it. I mean, we have a lot of good folks that are involved in emergency work, not only in my organization, but throughout the county. Obviously, we all talk and sort of compare notes. And, you know, the thing that we're hearing is we're all in this together, and it's true. That's not only true for the public, but it's also true for those of us in emergency work.
We have in Luzerne County, I think, in particular, we have a group of highly motivated, where there's shortages of volunteers all over the country. Michael, wouldn't you say that volunteer spirit is very much alive and well in Luzerne County when it comes to EMS? And some of there are folks that have been in that business for decades, and just real familiar faces, some of the people on Michael's committee. But Michael talks about being prepared, you know, at the federal and state level, at every level. I think the world, the United States, in many respects, sadly, was woefully unprepared for this crisis. But when you look at organizations like Michael's, they train regularly. They maintain proficiency training. These are folks that are nurses and medics for other organizations and serve at the Greater Pittston Ambulance Association. That's one group we can say was very well prepared. And that's a feather in your cap, Michael, because you've been at the administrative level of that organization for many, many years, too.
Yeah, the point that you make is true. There's a lot of people in our organization and some of the other great organizations in the county that are really passionate about the work. There's people in our organization that, you know, we joke that sometimes we don't have a lot of the other traditional hobbies and that a lot of our free time is spent trying to improve the organization. And it's a labor of love. It's not that we're doing that for any other reason. We enjoy it. It's something that I've always said that I'll continue to do it until it's no longer enjoyable for me. And that's never really been the issue. It's really a labor of love, not only for me, but everyone else that's involved in the organization. You raise the issue of preparedness. And it's interesting that a pandemic, is it something that we talked about in the past? Sure. But in terms of what the most likely type of major emergency that you'll face or that you would face in the past, it's not something that we really talked about a whole heck of a lot. What's one of the things that we've had to be mindful of the last couple of years? Mass shootings. We've seen a lot of them in our country, in the school environment, in the workplace. That's something that we spent a lot of time training for over the course of the last couple of years. There's different classes that we've taken and put our members through to make sure that we're prepared for that. But pandemics are something that, you know, it's something that we were mindful of, but it's not something that on the continuum of likelihood was at the forefront of our minds.
Well, and the major difference between the major difference there, Michael, is you're talking about a sprint versus a marathon. I mean, this is something that's going to go on and on and on for weeks, requiring your personnel who may become fatigued and covering these shifts and demands on your equipment. This is something so far afield from, and I know I've seen some of the trainings you guys were a part of. They do active shooter trainings and things of that nature. Right. This is just such a tremendous lengthy demand and tax on an organization like yours across the world. I just don't know how you prepare for something like that.
Yeah, you've brought up a number of different points that we can talk about. In terms of preparedness, we started to hear rumblings of this issue of coronavirus back in January. And we have the gear that we need to respond to this in terms of personal protective gear, masks, gowns, the sorts of things that you're seeing on the news that, you know, civilians never really would think about in the past. But we started thinking about that stuff back in January. Even as early as January, for us, through the normal supply chains that we go through to get our gear and get our equipment, we were having difficulty getting that stuff before this really came into the national consciousness. And that's something that, in terms of this gear, we're using it now on every call. Whereas in the past, this is stuff that it would be very unusual for us to have to use it on your typical call. You'd only maybe use it once a week or once a month, but it's stuff that we have to use on every call now. So we're going through supplies in a much more rapid pace. So it's not that we weren't prepared, but as you said before, there's no real end in sight. There's no endpoint. As you said, a mass shooting event, as terrible as it is, it has a defined endpoint. We don't know when we're going to be finished with this disease. In fact, even when we are finished, it may reappear in the fall. Fortunately, that's what we're hearing now, that it may make a comeback. Even when we start to get on the other side of the bell curve, we may see it again. So some of the things that we would like to do to prepare, we weren't able to just because supply chains were not supporting it. In our case, as early as January, before it really became such a national
Michael, think about concern. What you just said. I mean, think about what you just said. And I could tell you, I ordered masks on January 31st through Amazon. Just as like 50 masks, I listened to an NPR broadcast in the morning and the numbers were staggering out of Wuhan. Okay. And now we have, and I don't want to politicize the deal, but you can't not, but we had the governor of Georgia yesterday say 24 hours ago, he just learned that this disease travels through the air. You know, somebody whose head is completely buried in the sand, where in January, I'm listening to NPR publications and I ordered these 50 masks from Amazon. We never got them. It says to be delivered or delivery problem. I'm sure they've been sold for 10 times their value in the black market. But, you know, as a personal choice and as a local organization, you began to prepare yourself. You began to address your equipment need. You began to prepare your fleet to respond to the crisis, where on the national and state levels, we didn't see that. We saw them downplaying the coronavirus and its ultimate impact.
It's interesting that you raised that point. I think a lot of that was, I think that they didn't want the public to know to the degree how bad it could be because they didn't want panic buying to start earlier than it did. The point that you made in terms of the availability to get masks, let's talk about masks, because now what are we hearing? Now they want everyone to mask up out in public. That probably would have been the best practice a month ago, 8 weeks ago, I think that the reason that wasn't put out there to the public at large is because it was going to crimp what was already a supply problem. So I think that that best practice was kind of held back because there was a recognition on the state and federal level that if we put this out there, everybody's got to wear a mask. Then the people who really need it, the people in healthcare, emergency service, et cetera, would have an even more difficult time than we are now getting that.
It's interesting when you talk about the masks. I had to go to the grocery store the other day, and a month ago, people were looking at you cross-eyed if you had a mask on in the grocery store. Like, sure, what are you doing? Now, now I'm in the grocery store, and I was wearing a mask a month ago. And, I'm in the grocery store the other day, and now you're looking at everybody who doesn't have a mask on. I'm like, what are you doing? I mean,
get away from me.
Far away from me as possible. But, Mike, whenever, Jared's asking about the preparedness and in terms of equipment, do you guys have everything that you need right now to do your jobs? And if you don't, what are you guys doing right now to try to get it? I mean, other than, I'm assuming that you probably don't have the same connection to Robert Kraft as the governor,
You never know. Michael knows a lot of people. You never know, right? He has a good connection to the Steinbrenner family, I think.
We try to use those connections. And if it benefits the organization, it's benefiting everybody. If we do well, it's good for everybody in the community. But and in terms of what you're asking, do we have PPE, personal protective equipment? We do. But our concern is that we're not going to have enough of it. So number one, we've been asking folks in the community, how can we help? That's what we've been putting out there, that if you have extra gear that you can spare, by all means, we would accept it. Beyond that, we've been working the supply chains that we obviously develop relationships with the companies that supply us our medical gear, not just the PPE, but the gear that we and equipment that we use on a day-to-day basis. So we're just working our accounts and trying to rely on those relationships that we built in the past. So we're okay for now, but we've changed some of the practices. A year ago, if we had a call where we had to use protective gear, we would dispose of it immediately after the call. But now some of the equipment, we're reusing it. For instance, an N95 mask, literature is being put out there now that you can use those more than single use. And we're having to do things like that to ensure that the gear that we do have will last us through this crisis. We're also using respirators that are multi-use respirators. We're using equipment that we can use over and over again, and multiple people can use the same respirator as long as you sanitize it correctly. So we're doing things like that. Interestingly enough, you might be surprised that our call volume has dropped. And this is true of most of the other EMS agencies, certainly in our area that I've been speaking with. I think that's a product of people who have what they feel are less serious medical emergencies. Under normal conditions, they'd call 911 and seek to be transported by an ambulance. But I think there's a lot of people that are fearful of going to the hospital now, given what's going on. So the lesser acuity or the lower acuity type of emergencies, we're not seeing those. We're only seeing the most serious of cases. And of course, we're seeing people that have been afflicted or maybe have suspicion of being afflicted. But our call volume has gone down, and that's going to lead to other issues for us and other EMS agencies, in the coming months.
I think, Michael, one of the other things we want to talk about, if we take it beyond Greater Pittston right now, is we're doing the show on a county level. We have 740 confirmed corona cases. I was with our county manager when we announced the first, just three Saturdays ago. Very, very scary. The number is growing as projected locally, but we have a cluster in Hazleton. We have a real cluster situation in Hazleton. They're within the Hazleton community where we're seeing large volumes. The Hispanic community in particular have ties to New York and New Jersey and are traveling back and forth to work. Quite honestly, there has not been a lot of compliance with the initial stay-at-home order, which was extremely frustrating. That has been a real challenge to the point where just this week, Dave Pedry called upon Governor Wolf to mobilize, if necessary, if he felt necessary, he would support the mobilization of the National Guard to ensure that people in Hazleton are being compliant, to work with people that need help, both as a protective measure for the sick and the healthy. Not that anybody wants to be in a military state, but the reality is you have a community, not a terribly large community, that if this was 3 weeks ago, those kind of numbers, they would have tented Hazleton at that point, like New Rochelle, New York.
Right. Yeah, it's a real concern. And, you know, you guys are on social media. You see what people in the community are saying. I mean, people are really scared. And, you know, we had the issue with buses coming from the New York metro area coming into this area. And you saw that kind of really blow up on social media. You know, people asking what could be done. I mean, we're all lawyers here. We know that under normal circumstances, people have a right to travel. It's hard for a local government or a county government to put an edict out that, hey, everybody stay out. It's not as easy as doing that, as much as we might like to do that. And that probably would have helped stem the crisis a little bit. We don't have the ability to do that in a free society. So I think that certainly Dave Pedry, the county manager, I know was looking to the state for some assistance in that regard, because I think it's something that perhaps the governor's office would certainly have a little bit easier time putting in effect that kind of edict. But, you know, there's obviously legal concerns and constitutional concerns by telling people that you can't travel into a particular area. But we're in uncharted waters.
Martz in particular has discontinued service 2 weeks ago. Yep. Scott Henry, the president of Martz, discontinued service, you know, to the detriment of his company. But at the same time, looking out for the community, whereas Greyhound is still running buses into Scranton. Mayor Cognetti this week has asked the head of Greyhound to cease traveling into the city of Scranton. I don't know that her letter has even been received yet, but I know as of today, they were still running buses in, which is a concern. You're taking individuals from a hot spot of the virus into an area of lower impact. Lackawanna County is exponentially lower at this point than we are. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. Some of what we talked about, the Hazleton connection to New York and New Jersey, I think, is driving a lot of what we're seeing in that community in particular. But at the same time, if you're allowing those buses to be a conduit, you could be transporting the virus regularly into your city, which is a great concern, certainly to Mayor Cognetti and the council up there. But they're trying to do something about it. And as you said, and Eddie is well aware, as lawyers, we know the novelty of trying to interfere with the right to travel.
Yeah. And another issue that has to come into the equation is personal responsibility. I mean, the government could certainly do things to limit travel, but, you know, we as individual citizens, we're not asking a lot of folks to just kind of stay put for a limited period of time. So there is some personal responsibility at play here. I mean, what do you guys see? I mean, just anecdotally, when I go around, I'm driving around, it still seems like there's a lot of people out and about.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there are. I mean, it, you know, it's really frightening. You know, the roads are, you go out for, you know, to get groceries, and the roads are still, there's still a lot of people out there. And
absolutely.
And it's truly frightening. And I think one of the reasons might be, kind of circling back to what Jared had mentioned earlier, there just has been such a lack of consistency in the messaging and the information. And it's been so politicized on the left and on the right that all of a sudden scientists and data and facts are now, you know, people are starting to doubt, oh, is that real? Is what the CDC is telling us, is that accurate or not accurate? You have the governor of Alabama who said, you know, a couple of days ago, like, I'm not going to social distance. I mean, it's so inherently irresponsible when you look at the actual science of this and what this virus is doing and how quickly it spreads. And, you know, speaking to the Greyhound stuff, I mean, you know, look, it's pretty simple. This virus, if it doesn't have new hosts, it will die.
Right.
I mean, that's what everybody, you know, everybody says that. So, you know, you have an area like New York City that is so dense in population, and the people, they live 6 feet from each other. I mean, most of them. So,
right.
You know, the likelihood is that if people in New York City have it and they're getting on buses or they're getting on trains and they're going to other places, it's going to go other places. So the only way that we're going to be able to contain this truly is by just staying home. If you have to go out for groceries, then make sure that you're doing the right things and you're wearing gloves, you're wearing a mask. But I will tell you, I was at Wegmans the other day, and I did not see everybody in Wegmans wearing gloves and masks. I mean, it's just,
no.
You know, from where what you seem like, and, you know, you're out there on the ambulance crews and everything else. The other thing that I really wanted to ask you about is when you take these people to the emergency rooms, mm-hmm. I can only imagine that it is just chaos there right now. Or is it? We hear about New York City, and obviously they're putting up tents in Central Park and things like that. And I think that that's on a level that is just so huge. But, you know, here, are our ERs becoming overwhelmed? Are they overrun? are the doctors and nurses just scrambling? Yeah. And, you know, what does it look like at the local ER?
It's a great question. And I think that the ERs, from what I've seen, just, you know, again, anecdotally, I'm not backing this up with data, but just what I've seen when I've been in there over the course of the last 2 or 3 weeks, that they're not as busy as they were prior to the crisis. And I think a lot of that is because some of the lower acuity stuff, just like we're seeing on the ambulance, those folks are just deciding not to go into the hospital to potentially expose themselves. What's happening in terms of if you do have to go to the emergency room, just to kind of give people a window into that. Obviously, we as providers, we're masking up on every call now. We're using PPE, protective gear, on every call now. What the hospitals are doing locally is they're requiring every patient that comes in to also have a mask on, whether they have COVID symptoms or not. We're just sort of operating and assuming that everybody has it and using those best practices. So if you're coming in, no matter if you come in with a broken arm, they're putting a mask over you before you enter the ER. And the ER also has someone stationed before you even hit the door to ask all those questions again. Did you travel anywhere? Anyone in your family have it? Do you have a fever or any of the other symptoms? Kind of going through that, you know, sort of Mirandizing people, to use a legal term, before they come into the ER. But I'm not seeing that peak or that incredible volume that we're seeing out of the video in New York. You know, speaking about New York, to me, Eddie, you raised the issue, and it's true. Population density is a big factor. But the numbers just seem so skyrocketed in New York that it just seems like something had to go wrong. You know, at some point, there's going to be a postmortem here.
I think that what went wrong, hello. Look, this is some of what happens when you work at home. See that?
Hey!
Victoria, say hi.
Hi, Victoria. Hi.
So one of the added benefits of this, you get to spend a lot of time at home with the kids. And but, Michael, I think in New York, it was there for such a period of time and spreading. Sure. You know, they're anticipating that this is going to be a really rough next 2 weeks here in the United States of America. And I wouldn't rather be anywhere but home, safe. You know, it befuddles me to see people out and about aimlessly at this point who just aren't getting what we're facing.
I agree.
And I think it's good locally that people have become their home medicating if they don't feel like they need to be running to the ER, because it gives our emergency room the opportunity to quarantine individuals. Now, I know two people in particular that I know have it, that have been positively diagnosed. And one is an elderly gentleman. One is a younger guy at or close to our age who's not doing well. He's presently in the ICU fighting for his life right now. And it's really Russian roulette with this virus. You know, it's strange.
Seems to be.
Some of the post-analysis that has to be done is the unpredictability of this. Overwhelmingly, it's affecting, as we all know and have heard, folks with pre-existing conditions, folks of an advanced age. But time and time again, we're seeing that proven wrong as well. So it's scary, you know, and it hits home when it's somebody you know and care about. Sad, and these people are alone suffering through this right now. But there is some good that's come out of this. I think that we've now moved away from, you know, we've done shows on the election and things that are going, we're moved away from some of the stories that have divided us as a country. And really, we all have a common enemy right now. And it's getting well and looking out for each other. And Michael's somebody that certainly has done that. But don't you guys think there's been also this period of, although it's an anxious time, there's been like a de-stressing and a coming home and a getting away from some of the noise that we're typically dealing with?
Yeah, I think you're seeing that. I mean, people are obviously spending more time with their families. That's a good thing. It's, you know, kind of a traditional kind of old school phenomena that sort of sprung from this. So you try to take the good with the bad and make the best of the situation. You know, hopefully a couple more weeks that we get on the other side of that curve and things start to improve. But in the meantime, we're trying to make the best of the hand that we've been dealt, right?
And, you know, if you look at what we all do for a living, if we can accomplish what we do remotely, I can't imagine there's too many professions that can't. I mean, so much of what we do is out of the office or in the office, meeting with clients, making things happen in court. Really, the only thing that's changed is we're not personally appearing in court. But everybody's still working, and you guys are working remotely, right, Ed? I mean, how are you finding that?
A number of years ago, I mean, we made a big investment in technology probably 3 or 4 years ago. We spent, you know, probably $250,000 just in investing in having everything online. So all of our people have been used to working remotely to some extent over the course of the last couple of years. So the working remotely for my office and my staff wasn't a huge switch. It was – more so trying to really understand what was going on in all of the county courts that we work in all over the state. Because, you know, what people don't understand is that the state courts, they all function kind of independently. So, you know, what Luzerne County is doing is different than what Schuylkill County is doing, and what Schuylkill County is doing is different than Philadelphia. So that was a little bit challenging, just trying to keep up with what the different court systems are doing. But I will tell you, we've had Zoom calls with the courts in Luzerne County, Lackawanna County, federal courts, Philadelphia, you know, county as well, even, you know, out towards Allegheny County, some of the counties out that way. And the court system has embraced this. I mean, overwhelmingly embraced it. Like, you know, look, especially on the civil end, you know, move your cases forward, do depositions by Zoom. We're going to do Zoom hearings. So I think that one of the things that we'll probably see coming out of this, which is a good, you know, really, really is a good thing, is that, you know, you're not going to have to go and sit in a cattle call in a courtroom for 2 hours or 3 hours. I think that, you know, they're going to do a Zoom hearing, and you might be able to take that hearing from your office. Jared, you could sit there in your sweatpants and you don't even have to get dressed anymore. But
That's going to happen in the criminal realm. We'll see that, you know, but
there's a lot of efficiencies that I think can start to come out of this as well.
And I think so too.
You know, the court systems, you know, one of the things that I think is going to be interesting to see what happens is, will there be more coordination in the county court systems? Because I think that we've seen now the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, I mean, they're pulling their hair out dealing with all these different president judges. And, you know, fortunately for us who, you know, we practice Luzerne and Lackawanna, we got great president judges who really embrace technology. But that's not true in all the counties in Pennsylvania. So
we have, and I can tell you, like, with Judge Vogue, he is a decisive man. I worked with Judge Vogue in the DA's office. So he didn't mess around with this. I mean, he saw it coming and he's adjusted, and our courts are functioning as they need to be. One of the things I think was difficult, a personal challenge for me, I represent a school district locally. So prior to the legislature leaving to get out of Harrisburg and to get back into their district offices, they passed Act 13 in the House, Senate Bill 751, and the governor signed it, basically mandating that teachers and employees in school districts get paid. But it left us struggling with the transportation contract and some of the other things, where really the goal was to take the state money and tax money we receive and maintain business as usual, even though schools are closed. What do we do about distance learning? So schools have had some real challenges, and we talk about deferring to the local level more than ever. I think there's been a great deal of deference to the particular districts. What I can say about the superintendents in Luzerne County is they're talking every day, every afternoon they talk. The solicitors always talk to each other. It's a fraternity that really relies on each other very much so, because the law is always changing. But it's been challenging as a school solicitor to make sure we do what we're directed to by the state and still do right by the district and our people. But we're moving along. One of the greatest challenges has been to meet our IEP special education needs for the children that have special education plans. That's always a challenge we welcome. But at this time, it's been particularly challenging. So for me personally and professionally, that's been the most significant challenge through the crisis. I mean, the crime is down here in Luzerne County, I could tell you, whereas we haven't had, fingers crossed, homicides or violent assaults. There was a shooting in Wilkes-Barre. It was dealt with. But for the most part, it seems like people are behaving themselves. But that can change at a moment. But I can tell you, like, that is something that I've seen, and it has allowed for us to kind of take inventory, manage the cases we have pending, but be ready in the event there's a situation we have to deal with.
Mike, how about the you know, the city of Pittston and the work that you do on council there? Tell us what's going on there, and what are you seeing, and what are the challenges that a city like Pittston is really facing at this particular point in time?
A couple of things, Ed. We jumped out ahead of it pretty early in terms of closing our buildings and taking some precautions, particularly with our emergency services, with fire and police, and putting some new procedures in place to limit their access. As a smaller city, we have to be concerned with our staff members. If we lose a couple members of the police force, a couple members of the fire department, you know, that have real impact on us. So we have to be careful in keeping them distant, more so than most people, because that could have a real impact on us. From an economic standpoint, our downtown has a lot of mom and pop restaurants, bars, et cetera. You know, we're concerned about that. We're concerned about the long-term impact. If they're closed for, you know, initially we thought this was just going to be a couple of weeks, right? Now it's going to be 6 weeks, maybe more. So we're certainly concerned about the impact that's going to have on our economic horizons. From a public health and a public safety standpoint, we haven't really seen a lot of issues. It really hasn't exploded like it has in Hazleton. So we haven't had to deal with that. We've talked about that internally in terms of what we would do and what procedures we'd put in place if we should see such a spike in cases here. So far, we haven't had to do that. We talked about those buses. You know, Greyhound is still running. Martz has stepped up and kind of done the right thing. But the other issue is those lower cost transportation vans that are continuing to run between the New York, New Jersey metro area and Tenipa. They have drop-off sites in pretty much every population center in Luzerne County. They advertise it, Google it, it'll come up. They advertise that they drop off Pittston, Nanticoke, Kingston, Wilkes-Barre, et cetera. We did put out a proclamation banning those services from dropping off in the city. Now, again, we're a smaller city. Do we really have the resources to prevent them? You know, I think that if they really wanted to come here, they probably could still do it and get around that edict that we put out. But we're at least trying to do that and hope that they'll comply voluntarily, because that is a major problem. And we've seen the results of that, I think, in Hazleton, because you've had that continuous back and forth, people really not listening to the health experts. But those are the challenges that we've seen here in the city and that continue to be concerned about and continue to monitor.
Are you guys having daily calls just to, you know, really kind of stay up on the situation in Pittston?
Yeah, we've embraced just by necessity the same technology that we just finished talking about, the Zoom technology we've used. We've been having department head meetings on a pretty regular basis. We obviously use texts and emails as much as we can, but we're in pretty constant contact with one another and making decisions based on how things change. But it's been pretty quiet here in terms of actual confirmed coronavirus cases. Of course, you know, one of the issues is that data. Are we getting data in real time from the Department of Health?
And well, that continues to tell you guys that there is a plan for increased testing locally. We're going to, in the next couple of days, we're going to have greater access to testing and have a better sense, Michael, at the local level, you know, what you just raised, whether or not you're getting that information. But again, that's because we've been identified as a region that's going to grow in the diagnosis. They don't bring that into communities that are diminishing the concern. And it's because of what's happening in Hazleton and stuff like that. But we're working with a couple of different operations to get testing increased and more readily available.
One of the issues that we're going to talk about at the county task force, the crisis committee, is once we have that data, or the Department of Health has that data, one of the concerns that's been continually raised with the emergency service community is that we need to know where those cases are. Our providers shouldn't be the canary in the coal mine going into a call and not knowing that there are cases in that particular address. We should have that information up front so we can take the appropriate precautions. As I said before, right now we're going into emergencies assuming that everyone has it. We're wearing PPE on every call. But we should be able to have that heightened sense of awareness and take even more precautions if we have that data. So I think that's something that we need to address with the county task force. That information, it just has to get out to emergency responders. If it's known by public health officials, that information needs to go to the people who are responding to those incidents. HIPAA is, you know, you guys know that from your practice. HIPAA has been with us for, what, almost 20 years now, probably. But we're in a crisis time now. And I think that the health and well-being of our responders trumps any privacy concerns. And the reality is, we're not looking for that information to unnecessarily intrude on someone's privacy. We're looking at it for the health and safety of our members. And I can tell you that anecdotally, I've heard from some other agencies that have had bad experiences with that. I know of one agency, I'm not going to name them, that was called to an incident at a residence. They were told one thing, but once they got that patient in the ambulance, the story changed. And a number of providers may have been exposed to the disease when they didn't have to be. If they had information beforehand, they could have protected themselves and protected the members on the crew.
That, to me, that's unacceptable. The blood is on the hands of the people that withhold that information under some bullshit law you know, this is not for to violate somebody's privacy. This is to protect the people and protect the people providing the care and to protect the people in that region. You know, it cannot be a sledgehammer approach. It has to be like a scalpel approach, or we're not going to get this thing. And Dave Pedry, you know, and again, I'm working with Dave pretty regularly, have been pushing the Department of Health to particularize the information we're getting. We get it, but not necessarily from them. Oftentimes, individuals are willing to share their diagnosis. I mean, I'm aware of some people that have it because family members have shared it with me, so on. But we can't be constrained by a protection that is far worse than the privacy interest it's aiming to protect. Really, the consequences are really, really bad if we don't know where we're having outbreaks and who has it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing is that HIPAA was never designed to allow somebody not to disclose their information to an individual who's going to be providing them healthcare. You know, so a first responder or, you know, a physician or a nurse, that's not the purpose of HIPAA. The purpose of HIPAA was to make sure that that information was not getting out to, you know, to the public, that somebody outside of being able to care for them, you know, would be violating that. So it's, I mean, for example, employers must, they can't tell the identity of an individual, but what they have to do is if there's employees that are going into businesses that have been deemed essential right now and somebody tests positive, then the employer has to tell everybody around them, like, look, you've potentially been exposed. And, you know, they have to provide reasonable accommodations, which is really personal protective equipment. I mean, that's really, you know, how do you, what is the reasonable accommodation during this particular time period? Either remove them from, you know, the workforce, which they, that person should be removed already, disinfect everything, and then you got to have personal protective equipment. That's the only way that you're going to be able to make sure that you're being safe. So it's amazing. We didn't think we could fill up 45 minutes to an hour, and we've been going. But,
you know, I never have a doubt, Eddie. I know, we can fill the time out of topic ever.
Honest to God, Jared and I could talk cats off a fish truck. you know, Mike, the last thing that, and it kind of goes along these same lines of just, you know, being responsible other than, you know, people staying at home. And if people do have to go out, what are some of the very simple measures that they can take to protect themselves and then protect everybody around them? I mean, we just heard the other day about wearing cotton masks or bandanas. I mean, you know, what are you seeing? And are those things going to ultimately be something that everybody should, if they can have an N95 mask, are these good alternative measures?
Yeah, I think if you do the best that you can with the resources that we have now, obviously not everyone has access to masks. I mean, we're talking about emergency personnel that don't have the amount of masks that we need. So how can a regular civilian get them? So I think that those alternative means, while it's not the best practice, it's the best that we can hope for under this situation, the circumstances that we're dealing with. So I think things like bandanas, those homemade masks, anything that's preventing those droplets from being expelled and protecting them from coming into your mucous membranes, your nose, your mouth, and your eyes are helpful. Because you have to remember, it's the eyes too. We forget about that sometimes. So when we're working in the emergency field, those folks that have glasses, that's a protective device. Those of us that don't wear glasses, we're wearing eye protection. So that's something to be mindful of. If you have glasses, that's a means of protection. But put sunglasses on, just something to prevent any material from getting in your eyes. Wear masks. Keeping your hands clean are an important thing. I see a lot of people that are walking around with gloves on now, but gloves are really designed for a single use, for a single activity. If you have gloves on, it's no different than bare hands if you're going around touching everything and touching other surfaces that may be contaminated. So I'm not sure that the continuous use of gloves is the best practice. I think what you have to be mindful of is keep your hands clean and keep your hands away from your face. But wearing gloves continuously really isn't solving anything. But those are things that I think if everyone is doing that, you might see the social distancing could end quicker if people are using those protections, because that's really what the whole point of social distancing is. You want to prevent that spread of the material. And if we're apart from one another, there's no opportunity for the material to spread. But using masks, using those best practices, covering your eyes, your face, and not touching your face, those are all the sorts of things that could stem the tide. It's really commonsensical type stuff that, you know, we never had to think about before, because what was the worst case scenario? You're going to get a cold or something like that. But now, you know, this has real consequences. So you have to be really be mindful of this.
I've washed the skin off my hands.
Yeah, man, it's great. That's what you have to do. Circling back, I don't know how much time we have left, but you touched on testing.
It's our show. Right. We got as much time as we want.
No commercial breaks. Jared had mentioned testing. And from the responder standpoint, another issue that's being raised and something that a lot of agencies are concerned about is the speed at which the testing comes back. So if we have a responder, police officer, firefighter, somebody working in EMS, if they get exposed and they have to get tested, they're benched. They can't go back to their agency until there's definitiveness, whether they have it or they don't have it. So in the meantime, they're benched, and whatever agency that they belong to is disadvantaged because it's one less responder that they have. And remember, the agency sizes around here are not big. We're not NYPD. We're not FDNY. You look at the amount of cases that the NYPD has, it's in the thousands of members that are affected, but they're still, you know, obviously policing the city. And why is that? Well, they have 30 to 40,000 members. That's more people than live in the city of Wilkes-Barre. So our agencies, when these providers, these personnel are getting exposed and they have to get tested, they're benched, their organization is disadvantaged. So one of the things that needs to happen, and another issue that we're going to be talking about at the county level, is how can we speed those results up so responders know whether or not they have it, and can, if they don't have it, they can get back in the game and serving their agency and serving their community.
Great. Jared, you want to bring us in for a landing?
Yes, I do. Michael, thank you. Certainly, you've been somebody we eyeballed as a guest. We wished it was under better circumstances, but it was very topical, and no doubt you'll be back. But we really appreciate the work you're doing and the work that you have done for a long time. This is not something you're new to at all. I know that. I know you're
passionate. Thank you guys for having me on.
Thank you. And thank you for everything you're doing.
Yeah, I enjoy it. And, you know, I appreciate the passion that both of you guys have, not only about this topic, but about the law in general. And, you know, it's great. It's great when you talk to guys who have the same passion and can speak and converse about these issues and really care about where we live and try to make it a better place in our own ways. We all have our own unique way that we can do that. And certainly just something as simple as a podcast, getting this information out and making people aware of different topics and sort of broadening their mind to think about different things that they might not be thinking about, is definitely doing a public service.
Well, I think it's also worth noting,
and Jared and I like to hear ourselves talk.
That's right.
There's nothing wrong with it. Hey, if what's coming out is valuable, then talk away. And I think what's coming out is definitely valuable.
That's certainly debatable. But one thing I do want to say, we're all three professionals here. Everybody's available for counsel if anybody needs it. You know, a lot of people are addressing their mortality, and Alex Russin, who's a guest of the show on occasion, can do people's estates, and we certainly do that kind of work. And I think there's going to be a lot of people needing help and companies needing help on some of the loan forgiveness programs and things. And I think lawyers are going to play, as we always do. You know, we get a bad rap, but we play a critical role at every aspect of life and in dealing with this crisis and the fallout from the crisis. So I think, and we couldn't have two better guys than the people I'm looking at right now at helping dig out from this. So, Michael,
it's interesting, Jared, we didn't even talk about it. You can do multiple shows probably on the legal implications from coronavirus, because imagine that we have three lawyers together here. We didn't even really scratch the surface on that topic, but it's really going to be an explosion.
We can, and that's coming, I'm sure. And, you know, you can get a headache when you think about all the things that need to be addressed coming up. So, but Michael, thank you so much. Eddie, it's great to see
you.
Thank you. Eddie is bearded at this point. You know, that's a contaminant of corona, too. Michael, tell him you have to shave during this process.
You know, Eddie, you're not going to get a proper seal if you're wearing a mask. You're not going to get a proper seal.
He's in the country. Listen, he's safe. He's safe up there.
I stay there this morning. This is how quickly it grows.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Great to see everybody.
All right, guys.
Take care, guys. Be well.